I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, one and all, and welcome to Book Off, the literary podcast with a difference. I'm your host, Joe Haddo, and I hope wherever you are in the world, you're staying safe and well and wearing a mask when you're out and about. Welcome to Series 6. Unbelievably, we are here, and if you're a new listener, a very warm welcome to you. There are loads of backlisted episodes for you to check out, should you wish. And if you're a regular listener, welcome back. It's lovely to have you with us. If you're listening via iTunes or Apple Podcasts, please do take a moment to rate and review Book Off, as it really helps us to spread the word to a wider audience. And if you're of the social media persuasion, then do give us a little shout out and say hello, because we always love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook at @OdoBookOff. In this episode, as always, I'm joined by two fabulous authors who'll be battling it out in a war of the words a little later on in the Book Off. We recorded this during lockdown, so it was recorded a couple of months ago, and so the interview is not in full quality. It was recorded over the internet, but hopefully you'll still find it entertaining. Anyway, enough from me. Let's meet our guests. I'm joined by a best-selling author and screenwriter and playwright who over his career has brought us a bounty of amazing books, including the Alex Rider series, his Sherlock Holmes novels and his Bond books too, as well as writing Foyle's War and Midsummer Murders. He's recently published a new whodunit called Moonflower Murders, which we'll be talking about today. Anthony Horowitz, hello, welcome to Book Off.
Very pleasant to be here, Joe. Very happy to be here.
And also I'm joined by a presenter, a producer, and now novelist who'll be known to many from the incredibly popular BBC One show Pointless. In fact, many of us, including myself, will be picturing him now, sat behind a desk, in a suit, looking resplendent and intelligent. Here to talk about his new novel, The Thursday Murder Club, it's Richard Osman. Hello.
Hello, Joe. How are you?
Really well, thank you. And all the better for having you and Anthony on the podcast to launch
our new series. You are quite right. I am sitting currently behind a desk, in a suit jacket, in a completely empty television studio, just waiting for everybody to come back.
And hopefully it won't be too much longer, eh?
Yeah, hopefully.
Usually we'd be sat around a table in a studio sipping coffee, and we'll all have met and chatted before starting. But obviously we're still in lockdown when this is being recorded, and we're all in different locations. So Anthony, Richard Anthony.
Hello, Anthony. I wish, I'm such a fan of Pointless, of course, and your other quiz shows, Richard. So I'm very sad that we're not actually able to have a drink and to see each other in the flesh, so to speak. But I also loved your book, so it's very nice to be talking to you.
Well, this is very kind. And let's start off on a good foot. I loved your last one as well. I wish we were meeting in person as well, because I've got an awful lot of books that you could have signed. But listen, these are the days in which we find ourselves.
Indeed.
There'll be time for signings in the future, no doubt, Richard, I'm sure.
Yeah.
It's great that we're all getting off on a good foot, because later on in the podcast, for any new listeners, Richard and Anthony will be going head-to-head in a war of the words, where each will get a chance to pitch to us a book that they absolutely love and they think that everyone should read. But to start with, I want to talk about both of your new novels. And Anthony, if I could come to you first, I want to talk about this new book, which probably it wasn't intended to be written, I don't believe, but it has been written.
you're quite right. I mean, some years ago, I wrote a book called Magpie Murders, which was a book within a book. It was a story of an editor, Susan Ryland, who discovers that the solution to a modern murder is concealed inside a book that she edited, the author of which, Alan Conway, is dead. And the book was probably my most successful murder mystery book. I think it was also my first, actually, and I think about it. But anyway, it did very well. So my publishers were very keen on me doing a sequel, added to which Magpie Murders is about to be on television. It's going to be filmed next year. And the producers wanted a sequel. So everyone was saying do a sequel. And to my surprise, a sequel sort of fell into my head. And that is Moonflower Murders, which picks up with Susan Ryland some years after Magpie Murders, now living in Crete and getting involved in a second murder mystery, the solution to which is also inside one of the books she edited.
And we find her in Crete at the beginning of the book, and life isn't quite as easy as it should be for her, is it?
Well, at the end of Magpie Murders, she's lost her job, she's been hurt, she's been ostracised, and she is alone, although with a boyfriend, and she's trying to run a hotel in Crete, which is not going very well. And in fact, she's thinking of packing it all and coming into England when a couple turn up and they tell her a story about a murder that took place on the wedding night of their daughter 8 years before. A man was arrested. The daughter always said that it was the wrong man and that the police had made a mistake. The daughter has recently read an Atticus Punt novel and has become absolutely certain that a mistake was made and knows who the real murderer was, but she's disappeared. And this is enough to get Susan onto the next plane back to England to investigate both the murder that took place in the hotel and the murder in the book she edited, and to see how the two of them connect.
I've been asking guests on the last series, which was sort of recorded during the beginning of what was our lockdown period, about how their creativity has been, because I know that a lot of people have just not been able to concentrate, whether that be working on projects they started or even just simply getting stuck into a book. How has it been for you, Anthony?
Well, I've been very busy. I've been doing a lot of writing. I mean, I've already started to work on a new whodunit with my other character, Daniel Hawthorne. So I've been as busy as ever. But I have to say that I found it quite difficult in many respects. That what used to take me 5 or 10 minutes somehow now takes me 2 hours. And the days are strangely elastic in the sense that they seem to go on forever, but they're over very quickly. Do you know that feeling where you suddenly get to 5 o'clock, which is when I would normally turn on Pointless, of course.
Lovely.
And suddenly the day has just vanished. And that I found strange. It's a sort of a sense of being even more. I mean, I joke that I've been self-isolating for the last 35 years, but I'm even more isolated than I was then.
How's it been for you, Richard, these past few months?
In terms of creativity, I did in January, I'm going to take 6 months off TV. Just to concentrate on writing the second novel. So I said, I'm not going to do any TV work for 6 months. I'm just going to sit at home and write. And, you know, you be careful what you wish for, right? So, in terms of time, it's fine. I'm going to hit a deadline, which I think might be a record for the publishing industry. My only thing, here's the current problem I've got. I don't know if any other authors have got this problem. Anthony will tell me if this is the case. So we just found out we're going back into studio, right, to do some House of Games. And so, obviously, over lockdown, I put on 2 stone. So I've got to lose 2 stone quite quickly, so I'm on a diet. Now, I find I'm almost incapable of writing because I'm really hungry. And I don't know if that, you know, so some of the great poets of old who couldn't write a poem without a drink in them. I worry now I can't write a novel without being carb-loaded. That's my slight lockdown concern. I need more sugar somehow.
I actually find the opposite, Richard. You know, I never have breakfast if I can avoid it anyway, because I find that if I'm actually hungry, it encourages me to write faster. So then I can say I'll have lunch as soon as I finish the chapter, sort of burning up sort of something inside me.
Tony Blair famously used to not go to the loo before a speech because he felt it gave him more of an intensity. And just more of a sense of urgency to his speaking. So he'd never go to the loo. So that's your version of that, right?
I'm tempted to say that's why so much of what he said was so full of you know what. But
So Anthony sort of starves himself, and you, yeah, Richard, feed yourself. So they're the sort of opposites. But am I right in thinking you are quite a big crime fiction fan as a reader?
Yeah, absolutely I am. And, you know, that's why I'm delighted that Anthony's back to doing whodunits, you know, because they're always an absolute treat. And I've always been a huge crime fan. And, you know, I've always been I was only came to the public consciousness maybe 10 years ago as a TV presenter. But I've been a writer for, many years and a TV executive and creative and all that kind of stuff. And the thing that I've always read for pleasure has been crime fiction. And so naturally that was the, you know, I'd always wanted to write a book, but Anthony will tell you this, it turns out it's really, really hard. And every time I've started over the years, something gets in the way and I've been doing something else and yada, yada. And then about 4 years ago, I just sort of thought, come on, you know, now's the time. And yeah, I've never made television shows that I wouldn't watch. That's always been my rule. There's plenty of people in TV who do. And so I definitely would never write a book that I wouldn't read and wouldn't be in a genre that I enjoyed. And so crime was perfect for me. And also, you don't have to read any books about how to write because you've sort of, it's seeped into the bones when you're writing a crime book. You know what you can play with. You know the tropes you can use. You know the angles that you can have a bit of fun with. And so it was, I don't think I could have written any other sort of book, really.
If I may say so, Richard, I think one of the pleasures of reading The Thursday Murder Club is that love of golden age, particularly detective fiction, and sort of classical detective fiction, permeates it. It absolutely glows out of the pages, and you could tell from reading it that what you just said was the case.
Oh, that's very kind. Thank you.
And do you want to tell us a little bit about The Thursday Murder Club, Richard, for those that haven't picked it up yet?
For sure. I went to visit the relative of the mother of a friend a few years ago in a beautiful retirement village. Down in the West Country, and it's a really beautiful place, you know, completely independent, not an old people's home, but just a place, got a restaurant, it's got a gym, a pool, it's got a beautiful kind of land, lakes and all sorts of things. And when I was there, I thought, wow, this is such a great sort of location for a murder, is the truth, because, you know, it's got that sort of beauty and it's cut off slightly and there's no mobile reception. And then the longer you spend there with these people, everyone there is 70 or above, and you have such a laugh, and everyone's drinking all the time, and everyone's got stories. And I just thought, well, if there was a murder, then somebody here would solve it, that's for sure. So as soon as I thought, well, look, here's a place for a murder, and here are my detectives, I literally went and started writing the next day. And the idea is it's four people in their 70s. And once a week, they meet up to solve cold cases. They've got one of their founding members used to be in the police, and they sit and have a couple of glasses of wine and try and solve unsolved cases. And then there's a real murder on their doorstep, and suddenly they're thrown into that. And the key for me is it's a very sort of cozy setup. Where it is, it's quite cozy. You think, oh, and four people in the 70s, how lovely, how charming. And I thought, no, don't write it cozy. You know, so I really throw the kitchen sink at this gang. You know, and bad stuff happens to them. But one of them is a former spy. One of them was a former trades union leader. One's a former nurse. One's a former psychiatrist. So between the four of them, these sort of gentle, innocent souls, they've been through everything. They've done everything. And they can respond to everything you throw at them. And they sort of, you know, they turn the investigation on its head. They're just a joy to write. And so, you know, you can just put this lovely little murder mystery through it. But they respond to it in a way that you perhaps haven't seen before in other books. I hope so, anyway.
Anthony, it's interesting you talking about Richard's book there and sort of feeling the influence, the glow of a lot of those crime novels that have gone before, etc. There's quite a Britishness to it, and I think in your novels as well, Anthony, there's quite a Britishness in some ways. That's part of their charm, and obviously we're here in the UK, and that's what we know, and that's what we write. But do you have to sort of rewrite these books for transatlantic audiences and take a lot of that Britishness out of it?
No, on the contrary, I think the transatlantic and European and, you know, Asian audiences love these books very much because they're so British and so set in sort of communities that are slightly, as in Richard's book, slightly not quite the norm, slightly to the edge of the norm, little isolated communities. I mean, after all, Midsummer Murders, which I wrote for many years, was a sort of a village of make-believe with thatched cottages and village greens and old ladies on tricycles, never, ever really existed. But I think that foreigners in particular like to think of England in that way.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's been the thing for me, because when the book started selling overseas, I was thinking, oh, what are they going to make it? What are the Americans going to make of it? And the Americans, honestly, they've changed about four words in the whole thing. They love, you know, it's a huge draw for them. They didn't understand the big thing. They said, we didn't understand what going for a slash means.
And I was like, oh, no.
Ron, yeah, exactly. Ron, who's the trades union leader at one point, goes into the woods for a slash. And they're like, what? why is he gone into the woods? So I had to explain that. And I had to explain what having a mooch around was. And that was pretty much it. They love the Englishness. They wouldn't even change the name of Robert Dias.
When I was reading the book, Richard, I thought you'd actually have to give footnotes because you hit so many British tropes and sort of, you know, from Waitrose through to sort of Strictly Dancing and all the things that everybody's talking about are in the book. So I thought you'd actually have to have annotations.
What I love in when I read the Golden Age fiction and stuff from the 30s and 40s and 50s and stuff, I love it when I read a book that has a real sense of time and place. And it's not trying to be universal, but it's saying, look, we are in a 1950s English market town and, you know, someone goes to the shop. So I love that sort of thing. So I thought, do you know what? Do you make this timeless? And I thought, no, I'm literally going to write about the world as it is on this particular day. And it's fun to read now. And in 30 years' time, you think, I hope people look back and just go, it has a sort of truth to it, if you know what I mean. Because I love reading that stuff about people's daily lives in the 50s, and there just happens to be a murder going on underneath it. There's a lot of references to Ryman's and Nigella and the Hairy Bikers and all sorts of things throughout, I admit.
You're both writers, but you both have TV backgrounds. You're both heavily involved in TV adaptations and things. Anthony, you wrote Midsummer Murders, as you said. You've wrote Fool's War. You've adapted your own things. Is it important to you as the writer, as a creator of these books and characters, that you are involved in anything that happens to them, whether that be a screen adaptation or another sort of branch of what they do?
Only to a certain extent. I think it's a dangerous thing for a writer to assume that he can control a television show or a film or whatever it is, an adaptation of their work. For example, I've just been an executive producer on Point Blank, the Alex Rider show, and that's been a huge success, and I can't help but feel that that's partly due to the fact that I didn't write it and I didn't try to control it and sat back and trusted the producer and Guy Burt, the writer, and everybody else who've made such a good fist of it. So, you know, because I work in both fields, I can tell if something is going wrong, but so far, touch wood, it never has.
Yeah. And Richard, are you going to be able to be hands off, or maybe you don't want to be on this one? Because you have sold the rights, haven't you? The film rights?
Yes, the film rights. TV. Yeah, I want TV to be hands off a film, funnily enough. Only because I've worked in TV my whole life, and we had an auction, and I sort of knew so many of the people pitching, and I thought, I'm going to really upset some people. So I thought, do you know what? I'm going to go the film route. And it's Amblin as well in the States, so nobody's going to mind. So that's the route I went. But I will say, firstly, I'll say, by the way, Foyle's War is my mum's favourite television programme of all time.
Thank you.
All time.
So many mums amongst my fans, Richard. Thank you.
Well, hey, listen, you and me both, Anthony. But my view is the same as Anthony's. You know, I've worked in telly my whole life, and it's an incredibly collaborative industry. And you have ideas and you have brilliant teams. And my experience has been employ the right people and they get the job done. They do it properly. And in terms of film, so Amblin are a great company. Ol Parker is doing the script and signed up to direct. And Ol will do a better job than me of writing the script of this book. You know, and also I want to get on with the second book. You know, I would just rather leave it to the professionals. And I'll dip in and, you know, he'll be on the phone and ask this, that, and the other. But these people are brilliant at writing films, and I'm not. So you just find the right people and leave them to it, really.
Yeah, yeah. And this is the first of what will be a series then, Richard?
Yeah, that's the idea. So, yeah, the first one's out on September the 3rd, the Thursday Murder Club. I'm writing the second one at the moment. I'm pretty near the end of the second one, which I know is weird, but all writers will be used to. And, yeah, and everyone who survives the first book returns for the second one. So anyone who gets through unscathed returns. And, you know, it feels to... I mean, Anthony's written all sorts of series, and it's just brilliant spending time with these. When you know the characters already, you immediately just think, well, you can get a great story, and then think, oh, well, how would that character react? How would that character react? And to me, it's been a pleasure. I mean, ask me after six of them and I'll be desperate to kill all of them off. But at the moment, I wish them all a very long life.
Do you have a title, Richard?
For the second one, I don't, actually, which is interesting.
I was wondering if it's
going to
be the Friday Murder Club. I mean, you could then do seven.
Well, you know, I mean, it's sort of tempting, isn't it? But that's the interesting thing. You know, again, the TV thing, I came up with the title, The Thursday Murder Club, where this retirement village, there's clubs all the time. People meet up and they sort of have, you know, wine tasting societies and all sorts of stuff and knit and natter and stuff. And the second I thought of The Thursday Murder Club, I thought, oh, great, because it's got murder on the front. It kind of does all your work for you. And titles in telly and in books are so important. And then this one, I'm desperately thinking, oh, I mean, The Thursday Murder Club rides again. I mean, you've got to be so careful. to kind of send the right messages out.
So I wondered, Richard, I wondered if you read Chesterton at all when you were thinking of that title. It struck me as very G.K. Chesterton title.
Yes, isn't it? Because of the man, exactly. Well, I live, funnily enough, in the, what was that book called? The Man Who Was Thursday? I always get
indeed.
Quite wrong.
And also, of course, the Club of Queer Trades. So,
but this is where I live, where that is set. Literally, I live in the little group of houses in Chiswick where he set The Man Who Was Thursday. So I wonder if somewhere in the back of my mind that was that was playing with me.
I've found talking to many authors, as I do on this podcast, that there are lots of different approaches to titles. And there are some authors that say, you know, I've got to have the title before I can even start writing the book. And others that say, oh, I just put something down and then, you know, I'll work it out at the end. Anthony, what's your sort of way into titles for the books? Do you start with it or do you just start writing it?
It depends. I mean, some of the Alex Rider books have begun with a title. I mean, I thought up a title years and years ago, once in the bath, and the title was The Falcon's Malteser, which is a sort of a spoof of my favourite film. It took me a year to try and work out a plot that would involve a small packet of chocolates and a large bird. So that was a title coming first. Often I have to spend a lot of time chasing a title. It is, as Richard correctly says, I mean, it is so important. You've got this little advertising space to sell your book with a picture, your name and a title. And that, I think, is a big part of a purchaser's, you know, choice and how they choose. So you have to get it right. And I don't know why I've been stuck now with M's. I mean, Midsummer Murders I wrote for 4 years, then Magpie Murders, now Moonflower Murders. I really am going to have to move off a letter M. I see, move on in the alphabet or something. But
did your title come first, Richard? I think you from what you were saying there, it did.
It came really early, and that's important to me because I work in telly. You know, titles, obviously, you know, with telly, you're coming up with 10 shows a year, right? And so titles are a big deal. And what Anthony said is great because I very rarely hear that from authors, and I'm a great believer, which is the front page of your book is essentially like an advert. That's what it is, and every word really counts. It's really small, and every word absolutely counts. Because in telly, so we did a show years ago called Beat the Nation, right? We asked 100 people to answer questions, and that was what the show was based on. And the show didn't really go anywhere, right? But it did all right on Channel 4, had a few series. We then took exactly the same principle. We asked 100 people, and someone in the room just said, oh, why don't we call it Pointless? And immediately you go, oh, because suddenly you're having pointless meetings, and you're having a pointless pitch with the BBC, and you say, oh, we could do it with celebrities and call it Pointless Celebrities. And you suddenly the whole thing takes on a life sort of bigger than itself. So listen, if you write a great book, you'll get away with it without a title. But if you've got a great title as well, it's an incredible sales tool. And if you've written a book you're proud of, you want as many people to read it as possible, and you want them to come into it in the right mood. And right mood is usually set by the front cover and the title, which are incredibly important.
Yeah, and I work in radio, and I've got this sort of almost awful habit of just writing pun titles down. You know, whenever something comes up, you're probably the same. And I've got this big list of them, you know, a whole list of titles that I haven't done anything with.
Well, I've just sold a series to Quibi in America, a series. I thought, I think, of a title, which was Nine Bodies in a Mexican Morgue. And they heard that title and just said, yes. You'll notice, incidentally, Mexican Morgue is still on those damned M's. But anyway, that sold it. And the book I'm writing at the moment, again, the title sort of fell into my lap. It's another Diamond Brothers show, so I'm actually writing this now. It's called Where Seagulls Dare, and I'm enjoying writing that, if you like your puns. Nice.
Yeah, I love a pun. Nice. I just can't ever let a pun go. Very shortly, we'll turn to the book off, where both of you are going to tell us about a book that you love and why we should all read it. Before that, Anthony, I just want to come back to you because we are talking about your new book, which is out. But I have learnt from a previous conversation that you're also writing at the moment another Hawthorne novel.
Yes, that's right. The first one was called The Word is Murder, and the sentence is death. The next one, I think, is called The Killer Question. And this is a series of books in which a detective, Daniel Hawthorne, hires a writer to basically tell his story, to be his Watson, and the two of them will share the profits. And where the books are peculiar is that the writer he hires is me. So I'm actually in the book as Watson, rather than the author of the book. The author is always the most clever person in the detective story because they know everything from the start. But if you're actually inside the book as the narrator, you know nothing. And that, I think, is interesting and sort of does things to the whodunit form, which I find interesting and allow me to sort of write about the genre and about what it's like to be a writer.
Are there times when, you know, you're writing a murder mystery, essentially, a whodunit, where you just can't get what that little twist is, or that one piece of info that's going to bring the whole thing together?
No, the hardest thing I find, and I'm interested if Richard has the same problem, if it is indeed a problem at all, is to start with the reason for the murder. All murder mystery whodunits begin with a very simple equation. A plus B equals C. A is one person, B is another person, C is the reason why A murders B. And once you've got that, and it's original and interesting, and you start thinking about who those people are and what surrounds them, then the book forms. But I find that the hardest thing, to find something interesting. It can't just be because she was having an affair or I wanted his money. It's got to be something sort of more interesting about that. And that's how I find is the hardest part of it.
Yeah, I would agree entirely with that. I had absolutely no spoilers, but there was one little thought I had on Thursday Murder Club. I thought, okay, that's interesting. And from there, everything hung off that. So I knew my ending, and I knew I had something which I thought was quite new. And then the fun is weaving stuff around that. But, you know, having your characters and little red herrings and how you hide them, and, you know, just sort of building that puzzle is such an absolute joy. And I think to the original question, the things where you think, well, this bit is impossible. A very good friend of mine, the playwright Lucy Preble, I was talking to her, I said, I've got this thing and it's impossible. And she said, well, that's the book, though. You solve the impossible thing, because, you know, if it takes you a week, the readers are not going to solve it, you know, within an hour when they're reading it. So, you know, it's overcoming the impossible bits that makes a book kind of really sing.
Does it matter to you, Richard, if your readers guess the ending? Do you get annoyed if someone says, oh, I loved it, but I guessed the ending? Or do you think to yourself, well, actually, that's a result?
No, I would rather fool them. That's definitely the truth. I would rather, you know, that's... And I think I haven't fooled most people with this thus far. So I would much rather fool them. But if you can work it out, but it's quite complicated to work out, then you're going to feel good about yourself, so you'll like it anyway. So I think if you work it out and it's been hard to work out, you'll enjoy it. And if you haven't worked it out, but it's satisfying, then you'll enjoy it as well. But it's nice to fool people, Anthony, right? It's nice to think, you didn't spot this, did you? So, you know, the Shawshank Redemption, because the whole thing in a crime book is hide your MacGuffin, hide the thing that solves the mystery. You know, so it's there throughout, but you hide it. Now, in Shawshank Redemption, you the thing of the poster on the wall, which goes from Rita Hayworth to Raquel Welch. And so what you think is, because you watch those films, is, oh, that's a passage of time thing. That's a very clever little, that's nice. He's been in there such a long time that the poster has changed. And, of course, that's the MacGuffin. So he's, you know, it's so clever.
And it's that beautiful moment as a viewer or a reader where it all just sort of slots into place towards the end and you go, you bastards.
Yeah, and especially if you can then read back and go, oh, you told me. You literally told me. Yeah, I love all that.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Well, it's time for the book off now. And as I said, this is where each of you get 3 minutes on the clock to tell us about a book that you absolutely love. It doesn't have to be your favourite book. It just has to be something that you think everyone should read at some point in their lives. And you don't have to use your full 3 minutes if you don't want to. But when we reach that 3 minute mark, you will either be honked out or given a good old ring. We need to determine who goes first and who goes second. We also need to determine the weapons of choice. So, Anthony, would you like to go first or second in the book off?
Well, I prefer to go second, actually. I can hear how Richard does it, how a pro does it. Just,
so you will be second. That means, Richard, you get to choose whether you would like the horn or the bell.
I'll say first how disingenuous that is of Anthony, one of the greatest pitchers of all time. This is a guy who can sum up a concept and an idea in about two sentences and has made an absolute fortune doing it. But I think I'll go with the bell. I wouldn't want to be honked out.
Very good. No, that's okay. The bell it shall be. And I'll put 3 minutes on the clock. Before we start it, though, could you just tell us, Richard, which book you're going to be talking about?
My book is Towards the End of the Morning by Michael Frayn.
Okay. It's over to you then. You have 3 minutes if you want it to tell us about this book.
Well, firstly, I'll say it's absolutely typical of publishing that you've got 3 minutes to pitch, which in a TV pitch would be insane. If you can't do it within about 10 seconds or so, then it's off the table. But publishing moves more slowly than that, and I would need probably 25 seconds to pitch this book, I suspect. But I'll be a bit more languorous just for the format. So Michael Frayn, I think, is one of the greatest writers in the English language, and he can sort of do everything from Copenhagen, which is an incredible sort of philosophical play, to Noises Off, which is a farce. And I think Towards the End of the Morning is one of the funniest books ever written. It's set in the 1960s Fleet Street, when that kind of the old days of Fleet Street had just coming to the end, and a guy called John Dyson is working in the crossword and nature notes department of a small newspaper. And it's a wonderful evocation of that era. But the key thing with John Dyson is he realizes he's at the end of a particular time, and he wants to move into television. That's his big thing. And Michael Frayn just writes this beautiful novel filled with very believable characters, filled with a real sense of time, this end of an industry, the end of this hard drinking industry, something of course now which doesn't exist at all. There's nothing in Fleet Street. And also the beginning of an industry, which is television, and the sort of the slightly huckster people he's having to deal with. Throughout this huge comic set pieces, they go on a jaunt abroad. But basically, I think it's one of the most beautiful, elegiac, funny novels you could possibly read. It's very British, again. And Michael Frayn himself says, look, I think this would be a far more... This goes to what we were just speaking about. He says, I think this would be a much, much, much more successful book if I'd given it a different title. He said, nobody, even if I just told them, can remember the title Towards the End of the Morning. It doesn't really mean anything. No one can remember it. Now, in the States, interestingly, they gave it a different title, but it was also unsuccessful because the title in the States was Against Entropy, which, if anything, is even worse. So if you gave this a catchy title, I think it would be up there with a book which does have a catchy title, Scoop, as one of the greatest comic novels in the English language.
Fantastic.
And that is all I have to say.
Wow. Well, you had 30 seconds to spare, but you didn't need it. What a pitch, indeed. That is brilliant work. We're going to come back and talk about that book, but you get a rest now because I'm putting 3 minutes back on the clock. So you catch your breath because it's Anthony's turn.
Anthony won't need 3 minutes. He won't need 3 minutes.
I won't need three minutes on this, I can tell you.
You just need to tell us, first of all, what book you're going to be talking about.
Okay, well, before I tell you the title of the book, I want to explain something, which is that when you gave me this brief, and incidentally, this is my time starting now, when you gave me this brief, I misinterpreted this idea, because when you said the book that everybody ought to read, everybody should read, I thought it's got to be something major. Like, you know, my first thought was the Bible or the Quran or something huge. And so I thought to myself, what big books have I sort of read in my life that have stayed with me? And I chose, therefore, for this, Homer's The Odyssey. And after what Richard has just so eloquently done, I feel that just sounds like pretentious and sort of terrible. But let me just row back and say that the reason I've chosen it is that I did read it, not of course in the original Greek, but in a translation when I was in my teens or 20s. It has stayed with me for life because it is the first great novel written in Western culture. It is where everything begins. And actually, the story of Odysseus, the very fact that everybody now uses the word Odyssey in their language to describe a sort of a journey and a homecoming, it's somehow incredibly primal. It actually takes us back to who we are, where we have come from. And this book, it's not what you think of as just being a sort of a great classic epic poem or whatever you think. It is actually a wonderful story full of fantastic characters. Think, for example, everybody knows the Cyclops, Polyphemus, who is tricked by Odysseus, or Circe, who turns all the men into swine, or Iolaus, who gives Odysseus a bag full of the winds, and then one of the sailors opens it just as he's about to arrive home. The winds all release and blow him all the way back to Troy again. And everybody understands that frustration. It's got fantastic female characters in it, considering it was written over, you know, it was written in the 8th century BC, so you get to characters like Penelope, who is so strong and so clever, or for that matter, Calypso, who keeps Odysseus a prisoner for 7 years and won't let him go. And there are some wonderful moments in it, the blinding of the Polyphemus, or the death of Antinous, which is a wonderful piece of writing. So go to the Greek myths and legends, go to the gods and man, understand the world, understand where we've come from. It's where all literature begins.
Wow. Fantastic. That was, again, a two-minuter, a straight two-minuter there. I can tell you've both done quite a lot in TV.
And we were succinct. We were both stretching that out. We'd have done 10 seconds if you'd let us.
I should have had a clock going beside me. But instead, I will read the Michael Frayn. I mean, I do love his work. And he's probably the most versatile writer in the world. You think, this is the man who wrote both Copenhagen and Noises Off. How is that even possible?
Amazing, right? Amazing. Humour in literature is vastly underrated. You know, being funny is quite difficult. And certainly being funny while still writing a believable novel is underrated. And, you know, someone like Michael Frayn, he can write anything you want. But if he wants to be funny, he can be incredibly funny.
But it's so hard, isn't it, Richard? It genuinely is hard to be funny in fiction, I think. And I think it sort of can often put people off because it's so subjective anyway, comedy, that when someone says, it's a funny book, people can often sort of go, I'm not sure. But to do it genuinely brilliantly is a real skill. And it has happened, you know, and I think of something like Cold Comfort Farm that just had me in stitches all the way through. I haven't read this book by Frayn, and I absolutely want to, having heard you discuss it. And about, you know, everything that comes with it, the fact that it's Fleet Street and it's that sort of end of an era and the TV industry is sort of coming into play and everything. But just, you know, the fact that you can say now, it made me laugh, and genuinely laugh. And I think it's such a joy to read a funny book when it's done well, especially in these times.
Yeah, absolutely right.
And Anthony, I mean, the Odyssey is something that people talk about a lot. Like you say, the actual word Odyssey and the way it's used in our language now, people will reference it without really taking it back to Homer. And yet the statements of, you know, it being the first great novel in the Western world, and how important it is, the fact that there were strong female characters back then, and there's a whole host of characters in it that we know and love, and we don't know necessarily why we know their names, but it's all stems from that. Wow. Well, I think both great pitches. I've got to pick one because that's the game.
Can I give one final thing for my book above
you may.
Anthony's? It is much shorter. The single most underrated thing in literature. It's quite short.
Yeah, and I love a short book, I have to say.
For this age of, you know, everything in bite-sized chunks, I suppose the Odyssey is asking a little bit much now I think about it. Yeah. But as I said, I refer back to your earlier question, which is, this is a book everyone should read, not that everyone will necessarily enjoy. Oh, God, that wasn't right. It sounded very good. But you know what I mean? It's not about instant pleasure. It's not about instant gratification. That's what I'm saying.
And that says the man who's just signed a deal with Quibi.
If I did the Odyssey in 8-minute chunks like Quibi, I'd be writing it for the next 70 years.
that's a good pitch, though. Good money in that.
Yeah, that's a nice long-running, long-form idea there, isn't it? No, but you're right, Anthony, and everyone interprets it exactly how they want, and you are right. It's obviously a very important book, and everyone should read it, just to say they have as well. So I'm going to pick for today's book off. I'm going to take home the Michael Frayn. Because I need a laugh, basically. I'm in the mood.
We all do
laugh
right now, that's for sure.
And if I can get a laugh in under a couple of hundred pages, then that's even better.
Perfect, yeah.
Thank you both so much for joining me, for taking the time, for your brilliant insights into writing and those brilliant pitches as well. Both books are out now, and I hope that listeners will devour them like I have, because I really, really enjoyed reading them and spending time with your characters. Richard, what's next for you then, in terms of, you said, you know, back to studio pretty soon, so by the time people are listening to this podcast, you're probably already in there.
Yeah, September, hopefully we'll be back on air with another 100 Dosmond House of Games, which is a great fun show to do.
I think
we're probably back in studio with Pointless in December as well, and hopefully I'll be writing the third book.
Fantastic. And the Thursday Murder Club by Richard Osman is out now, and it's published by Viking. And Anthony, what is next for you on top of the Hawthorne that you're writing? Are we going to see anything else from you?
Just as I say, Magpie Murders is my sort of main occupation, and we hope to start shooting that in January, February, so I'll be working on that for that time. And then writing the Hawthorne and whatever else comes my way.
Moonflower Murders, All the M's by Anthony Horowitz is out now as well. That's published by Century. And they are both absolutely fantastic reads, as I said. So get yourself a copy of each one and enjoy. Anthony, Richard, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Joe.
Thanks, Joe.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.